Welcome to WMNF on 88.5 FM. I'm Sean Canaan. The COVID-19 pandemic drags on, and in many places, like Florida, it keeps getting worse. Today, we're going to speak to a doctor to answer all sorts of your questions about the coronavirus. And if you have any questions, you can email them to dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. If you do text, please sign your name. Joining us by Zoom right now is Stacy DeLynn, MD. Welcome to WMNF, Stacy.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really glad you could join us. And I'm going to tell people something about your background so that you wrote about on Instagram so that people know that what your authority is here. You wrote on your Instagram account that you are a communicator of COVID-19 information. Your specialty and area of practice is gynecology, reproductive health, and family planning. But during the height of the COVID pandemic in the spring of 2020 in New York City, you were your clinic's associate medical director, and you followed the emerging evidence of COVID-19 and communicated that to your staff and to the public. So why should someone listen to someone whose specialty is reproductive health and gynecology on the expertise of COVID-19?
Good question. I think that we all as doctors, those of us who were responsible for keeping our patients safe and our staff safe, had to really get immersed in the COVID science and figure out how to survive. You know, I was in New York City during the height of it, and now I'm here in Florida during another serious wave. And so, you know, what I do through my Instagram is try and answer what I know about. I have a background in clinical research and medicine, but I also, through my Instagram, like to pull in other experts, virologists, epidemiologists, to get their opinion. And I just do my best to translate the science that the major medical bodies are stating that, you know, is the latest data. And so I often say on my Instagram, no one should trust just me, one doctor. And anytime you see one doctor who's got an idea that they're sharing or something that they're selling, they're not the person to look to, but I just do my best to help translate the information that the major regulatory bodies and major medical organizations, which is comprised of thousands of scientists and hundreds of pieces of research, to look at all the available evidence and data to tell us the things that we know that are safe, including things like mask wearing, vaccines, et cetera.
And that's something that we'll talk about as the show goes on. How do you know who to trust and where do you get good information? And how can you recognize misinformation? All that are things that I hope to speak about during this hour. I just want to remind people that my guest is Stacy DeLynn, MD, and she is going to be talking to you this hour about answering my questions and probably answering your questions about the COVID-19 pandemic, why there's a surge right now, especially in Florida. One of the first things I wanted to talk about is the biggest news this week so far, which is that yesterday the U.S. Food and Drug Administration gave full approval to the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. So explain to people what that means, full approval versus, well, wait a second, I already got the shot. It wasn't fully approved. Could this push some people who are vaccine holdouts toward getting a jab?
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so. A lot of the polling indicates that people were waiting for this final FDA authorization. The way that you were able to get your vaccine before we had full FDA approval was that it was approved under something called emergency use authorization. And in certain, you know, public health crises, this EUA, emergency use authorization, does exist because the full FDA approval process takes a lot of time. And I know for people who are waiting for it, it's just a lot of it's regulatory, a lot of it's paperwork. It takes some time to get all of it done. But we now have literally billions of data points around the world for people who have received this vaccine safely. We've seen no major medical health outcomes to this vaccine. And we do see very, very severe health outcomes with COVID infection. We've had 630,000 deaths here in the U.S., billions worldwide. Know that the vaccine is safe, effective, and COVID infection for those who survive it. People are often left with long-term debilitating health outcomes. And we know for the people who are survived but are in hospitals, as we can see here in Florida, the hospitals are completely overwhelmed to the point where people needing regular medical care aren't able to access it. And we're starting to see things like ventilators and ICUs have to be rationed because things are so severe. So it was long overdue. I hope that it helps people who wanted that final approval and authorization, helps them to get the vaccine. And it also means that it will give a number of, you know, businesses and organizations the sort of backup they need to require vaccination for things like employment, particularly in the areas of healthcare, the military, et cetera.
Our guest is Stacey DeLynn, MD, and she's talking to us this hour about the COVID-19 pandemic and about how you can protect yourself and protect your community. Let me read some of the statistics for Florida from August 13th through 19th. So the most recent week in which the state has provided us data, more than 21,400 positive coronavirus cases a day. That's either at or above the peak from January when it was really bad. So it's worse now. 150,118 positive cases during that week. Last week, we recorded 1,486 deaths. And Florida just became the third state to pass 3 million confirmed positive coronavirus cases. In Florida, more than 42,200 people have died. So why is it so bad in Florida? What's happening right now? And how do we improve that?
So, you know, I speak with a lot of epidemiologists and other public health experts, and no one is surprised that this happened in Florida. The main reason being, unfortunately, Governor DeSantis's actions to prohibit business establishments from requiring mask use, which we know is enormously protective and helpful. And in the states it's been used, it's helped to keep COVID rates down. Governor DeSantis has also banned businesses from requiring proof of vaccination, which would be a really great way to keep people safe within those establishments. And he's also, you know, been very vocal about having everything open. So we know that there are certain activities that are less safe, things like indoor dining, bars open, not distancing requirements, things like that. In other states that have implemented those, we've seen them help keep rates down. And then while we did in Florida, compared to some other states, have a decent percentage of our population vaccinated, I think the latest number was, it was over 50%. What primarily that meant was we have a large elderly population in Florida. And so the elderly, by and large, did get vaccinated, which really helped to keep deaths down. But young people in Florida very overwhelmingly did not get vaccinated. So the combination of the lack of mask wearing, the low vaccination rates, and particularly as the summer weather hit, when things get really hot outside and people move indoors more, it was sort of just the perfect storm. So this was expected. And not only just those mitigation measures not being there, but the Delta variant, which came to this country and is now the predominant variant across the country, but we know it's highly, highly infectious, significantly more so than the original coronavirus that we saw. It's as infectious as chickenpox, if not more so. It spreads much easier. You need less time to contact. And so it was all these things together were just very, very sadly a tinderbox.
Our guest is Stacey DeLynn, MD, and we're talking right now on WMNF Tampa. It's 10:14 in the morning. My name is Sean Canaan, and we're answering questions about COVID-19. And Stacey was just talking about the Delta variant and how much more contagious it is. Yesterday, there was the beginning of a hearing about requiring masks in schools. And during that hearing, which we'll hear more about later, I just want to bring this in because you were talking about the infectiousness of the Delta variant. One of the people who was talking about that to the judge compared it to compound interest, and that the compound interest rate essentially of the Delta variant is so much higher than the original variants. And so if you were stuck on an island and one person with a Delta variant came in over a number of weeks, you would have thousands and thousands of people infected versus only maybe dozens or hundreds of the first, just because of how infectious it is. So what is special about the Delta variant? What can you tell us about its anatomy or about the way it infects people or what it's going to take to combat it?
So one of the things that we know is viral load, how much virus a person carries and then can pass on to another person, it influences how much people get sick and how many other people they can get sick, the severity of their symptoms, et cetera. So we know that Delta loads are as much as 1,000 times higher than the original coronavirus that we knew. Just this severe viral load that occurs with people is really just really dangerous. And so the good news is that how to prevent getting it, those rules haven't changed. So mask wearing in indoor spaces is really important, and vaccination. And I know that we read a lot about breakthrough cases That some people who have been vaccinated are getting the Delta variant. And while that's true, we know for sure that their symptoms are dramatically reduced and that the amount of time that they can spread the virus is significantly less. And so, you know, each person who reported, oh yeah, I had the vaccine, but I still got sick. I had cold symptoms for a couple of days. You know, it's very possible that that person might have ended up hospitalized or dead. So we know that the vaccines continue to be incredibly effective against the Delta variant. So trying to stay in outdoor spaces as much as possible, wearing masks anytime you're indoor, and vaccination are really the keys to preventing spread of the Delta variant. The rules haven't really changed on that.
Are we still asking people to kind of keep their distance, doing some physical distancing and some social distancing?
Absolutely, that helps. The more people in a crowded space, you know, the more infectious the Delta variant is. So it is, you know, it limits your time inside stores. And you know, this isn't forever. This variant will start to drop as vaccine rates rise. But I think we need to be very, very cognizant of the enormous strain on healthcare facilities right now. So those of us who live in Florida taking extra caution.
And you mentioned earlier that Florida's rate is above 50% of vaccination, and that's partially because of the emphasis of getting so many elderly people vaccinated. But that's still very low. We heard this number a year ago, I think, and we might have a different handle on it now, but we've been hearing that maybe about 70% vaccination or so would be required to reach herd immunity. What can you tell people about herd immunity and maybe the idea that some people had that could happen without a vaccine, and then how it could happen with a vaccine?
Right. So you know, one way that I tell people to understand herd immunity is that occasionally there are measles or mumps cases that pop up, but almost all of us got that vaccine when we were kids, and it lasts pretty well throughout our lives. So just by virtue of all of us having, if there's a couple of those kind of breakthrough cases, we're all protected because the virus doesn't have a place to go very far. And so nobody knows exactly what the number is, so 70, maybe 80%, but you need a really, really high population of everyone vaccinated so that if someone does come down with the virus, the rest of the population around them is really well protected. You know, I think that a lot of people, as you mentioned, a lot of people have spoken about the fact that I don't need to get vaccinated because I had COVID infection before, but variants is what really changes that equation. So we've seen multiple instances around the world where we had a decent number of the population who had previous infection with coronavirus, India, Brazil, and then once a new variant arose, people do not have the protection that they need and get sick again. And so that we know that vaccines are significantly more effective, have much longer lasting immunity against all variants as compared to natural infection. So you know, if someone around you has said, I had an infection before, I'm good, I don't need the vaccine, it's absolutely not true. They absolutely can become infected with one of these new variants. And I'm, you know, to some extent, there's so much spread within the population right now, new variants are arising that we haven't identified yet. And so it's really, really important to get vaccinated to prevent infection.
Our guest is Stacey DeLynn, MD, and we're talking about the coronavirus and we're answering questions. I'm going to read an email question or two in just a second. But I also want to correct something. A minute ago, I mentioned a percentage of how many Floridians are vaccinated, and of the people that are 12 and over, so the people who are eligible to become vaccinated, the correct number is 55%. Still, that's low, but it's a different number than I gave, so I wanted to correct the record. Let me read an email or two first, if you don't mind. So Greg writes, he uses the hashtag pandemicide, and he asks, are Donald Trump, if this is too political, you don't have to answer it, but if you would like to, you can. So he writes, are Donald Trump, Ron DeFascist, and Greg Abbott guilty of pandemicide? That's Greg's question.
I think that what we know is that there are public health responses that can reduce deaths and can reduce hospitalizations. And so I really, really urge everyone to, you know, connect with their elected officials and talk to them about public health. And I think that without public health measures being implemented, more people will get sick, more people will get infected. And I will point out that all of those people that were mentioned, those governors and the president, are vaccinated. So if you are a supporter of those political officials, then it's really important to know that they themselves got vaccinated. And so to please do so.
Even if it does mean that they get booed when they mention it. Did you hear that the other night?
I did. Yeah, that's unfortunate. But I think that's an important thing to look at, you know, that the people who are in power or in charge, they're also talking to health experts, and they also understand for their own safety how important it is to get vaccinated. And Governor Abbott recently became infected with COVID, but he's vaccinated, and so he's doing well, and he had access to early medical treatment, things like monoclonal antibody, which a lot of people won't have access to in the same way that they do. Donald Trump, when he got infected with COVID, had access to the absolute best medical care in the world, and right now in the states of Florida and Texas, the hospitals are really, really overwhelmed, so it's very difficult to access healthcare right now.
And I should say that as I was about to come on the air, I saw this crawl on the bottom of the CNN screen that the Kentucky governor has rescinded its school mask mandate after a court blocked the order. So that's a Democratic governor, Andy Beshear in Kentucky, rescinding the school mask mandate. We'll talk more about mask mandates later, but I just thought I'd throw that one out there because it's something that we'll be talking about in Florida. The case in Florida about mask mandates will still continue. It's continuing today. In fact, let me play a story about that. This might be a good time, but first I'll introduce our guest again. Stacy DeLynn is a medical doctor, and we're talking about the coronavirus this hour. But let's talk about the trial that's going on. Governor Ron DeSantis's effort to stop school districts from mandating students wearing masks is in court this week. A Leon County judge is hearing a lawsuit that's been brought by a dozen parents who want to overturn the governor's mandate ban. Lynn Hatter reports day one of the testimony yesterday focused heavily on the transmissibility of the Delta variant. And this is what we were talking about when we brought up compound interest earlier. So here's a quick story, and we'll talk about it in just a second with Stacy DeLynn, MD, on 88.5 FM.
That if it were compound interest, investors would see a lot of money.
But in this case, it's exponential growth of a pretty terrifying infection.
That's University of South Florida epidemiologist Thomas Unash. Governor Ron DeSantis' administration has sought to stop school districts from mandating students wear face masks amid growing concern about kids who were once thought largely immune to the virus now becoming sicker. DeSantis has argued face coverings should be voluntary, and he has repeatedly pointed to a study from Brown University that questions the efficacy of face coverings in schools. But that study, says Unash, is not definitive.
They were trying to really disentangle, and rather unsuccessfully, in my opinion, and in their opinion, too, they were pretty upfront about the limitations of the study, a whole variety of different factors that could lead to you know, the results that they got, which basically showed that the masking really wasn't being of the students wasn't really being effective. But they did not really take into account the levels of community transmission when they tried to do this.
Unash notes the Brown University researchers also couldn't control for classroom density or ventilation, among other issues. A peer review is in progress, but it hasn't been completed, and that peer review is a must for validation and verification of findings. Parents in the lawsuit argue voluntary face mask use is an unacceptable risk to the health of their children, and they want districts to be able to mandate face coverings. Several have, despite the administration's threats of taking away funding and removing local officials from office. Michael Abel, an attorney for the state, says,
"When it comes to masking in schools, this is hardly a settled issue. There's an ongoing debate over whether masks are more harmful than beneficial to children or to school environments in general."
Well, that's a report from Lynn Hatter out of Tallahassee, which is where this trial is going on this week. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa. It's 10:25 in the morning, and my guest is Stacy DeLynn. So the state is arguing there that we don't know whether masks are harmful or helpful for kids during a deadly pandemic. Well, that was a lawyer arguing that. I'm going to ask a doctor. Stacy DeLynn, what's the answer about masks on kids?
Things I try to do is that I try to help people understand how evidence works. And so what they mentioned there was that Governor DeSantis was citing a study for his decision that was not peer reviewed, which is a really important process of having other scientists look at your work to make sure that it's sound. So while he's citing that one study, and you might often hear people cite a single study where they read about something, we can look at the organizations that do recommend masking for kids. And so that's the World Health Organization, the CDC, and the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is the major doctor organization that looks at it. There are absolutely no, across multiple studies, multiple bodies of evidence, no risk to having kids wear masks beyond the age of 2 years old. It doesn't impact their health negatively in any way. And there are absolutely benefits to preventing the spread of virus. And not only do we know that without masking that viruses spread in schools, but it is absolutely a point for transmission in the community. Unfortunately, kids less than 12 years old can't be vaccinated yet. And so they rely on us to protect them through our vaccination. But when they are at schools where masking is not there, they come home and they can spread it to family members who are vulnerable. And so I think that within all the counties, people see this on their daily lives. They're seeing so many students get sick just within the first couple weeks of school here in Florida. Teachers become infected, everyone going into quarantine. And so it's interesting to me that Governor DeSantis is trying to legislate something when he often talks about small government, because local districts within Florida are saying that they want to have their kids wear masks to keep their kids safe, to keep each other safe. So I think it's a huge example of overreach that flies in the face of public health. And absolutely, masking in kids is safe and it saves lives. And despite Governor DeSantis's one not peer-reviewed study, there are mountains of evidence to support this.
Our guest is Stacey DeLynn. She's a doctor, an MD, and we're talking about the coronavirus. On that subject of kids in masks and school boards requiring or not requiring people to wear masks, either teachers or students, the Pinellas School Board is meeting today to consider mandatory masking. 2 weeks ago, the school board decided to keep masks optional among students and staff. According to the Tampa Bay Times, in the first 2 weeks of classes, Pinellas County reported about 800 cases among students and staff, and that's compared to fewer than 50 over the same period last year. So 16 times more infections this year. And the one of the main differences is that masks were required last year, not required so far this year. There's, of course, the Delta variant. There's a lot of other factors, but it seems like this is some evidence, at least more evidence, that masking helps prevent the spread of COVID-19, even in kids, even in schools. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, beyond the like thousands of studies that you can cite to support this, it's obvious that people are using common sense within their own communities and seeing what happens. It's a direct and quick effect. And what's interesting about the Delta variant is that it doesn't tend to have the long lag time of the original coronavirus. You know, sometimes people could be asymptomatic for 2 weeks. In this case, most people are infectious and symptomatic within a few days just because the viral load is so high. So you are able to very shockingly see the direct cause and effect of the prevalence of the Delta variant combined with optional mask wearing.
Our guest is Stacey DeLynn, MD, and we're talking about the coronavirus variant this hour, and I'm sorry, the coronavirus Delta variant and other things related to COVID-19 this hour. Florida's positivity rate last week rose to 19.8%. It's the seventh straight weekly increase. This is based on data that the state released, and I'm getting these from the Tampa Bay Times on Sunday. The positivity rate is the highest among 12 to 19-year-olds. It's about 25%. And in all of the counties around the Tampa Bay area, it's pretty high rates. 22% in Hillsborough, 20% in Pinellas, 26% in Pasco, 28% in Polk, 28% in Hernando, and 19% in Manatee County. And there are 16,849 people hospitalized in Florida with COVID-19. Is there any way to tell? Are we still on the upswing of this peak, or are we reaching the plateau? What signs can we look at to see what the answer is to that?
There's unfortunately no indication that we've reached a plateau yet, which is really frightening to think about. I mean, those percent positivity rates, I mean, most experts think that that's underreported, for one. And number two, you know, anything above about 4% is considered high transmission, in which you should be really, really instituting, you know, mitigation measures. And if you look around the world, you know, like an example is New Zealand. They had, you know, a small handful of community transmission. And so, you know, they're in complete lockdown. And a lot of places around the world are doing their best to increase mitigation measures. But we have none. And, you know, just as a personal note, I drive past, I often see crowded bars and crowded restaurants. And so, you know, you can tell that some people may be changing their behavior, but unfortunately not enough are. So, you know, it's hard to know when the peak will be. We probably haven't reached it yet. It's really terrifying to think about. You know, my local hospital where I live has started converting its cafeteria into an ICU. As people probably read the news headlines this week, Orlando is at risk of not being able to purify its water because they use liquid oxygen and all the oxygen is being used to treat patients at the hospital. It's truly apocalyptic to think about and really, really terrifying. And so mitigation measures are necessary. And unfortunately, with a government who won't do them or enforce them, you know, if there's anybody who's listening, as much as you can to just really, really wear masks in indoor settings and get vaccinated and continue distancing. Sadly, an effective public health system means that you've got a body helping you make those decisions. And we don't have that right now. So we all sort of need to be our own advocates in safety, I think, at this moment, and just being really, really cautious with rates so staggeringly high.
Stacey DeLynn, MD, is our guest for the hour on WMNF Tampa. My name is Sean Canaan. It's 10:32 in the morning, and we're taking your questions. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org. You can also text us at 813-433-0885. Please sign your name. And you brought up the situation in Orlando where, like a lot of water treatment facilities, they use liquid oxygen to purify their water. And on Friday, Orlando mentioned, they said to their customers of Orlando Water, Orlando Utilities, please conserve water. Don't use so much water because we're running low on liquid oxygen because of the coronavirus. The hospitals need it. We need it. We're running low. Please conserve water. I saw over the weekend that one of Orlando's neighbors, Winter Park, also issued a similar order. I asked the Tampa Water Department, here's what they said. They said they do use liquid oxygen in their treatment of water, but the water treatment plant has been operating on lower than normal inventory levels of liquid oxygen recently. City of Tampa goes on to say, our supplier has continued to deliver a steady supply to us here at the facility. At this time, we are under normal operations. So in Tampa, at least, there's no potential water shortage. They haven't explicitly asked anyone to conserve water, but it could become a pandemic multiplier, perhaps, if we run out of fresh water or run low on fresh water because we need liquid oxygen for the hospitals. I don't know how to ask this, but what does that say about how dangerous of a situation we're in, Dr. Doolin?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I read those headlines, I just had to take a breath. Like, it just indicates the severity of, you know, as a doctor who's worked in hospitals for many years, thinking about a patient who needs oxygen and how scary and terrifying that is for a patient, that feeling of not being able to breathe. And then knowing that so many patients need that right now in our state, that we're running out of enough just to maintain our basic utilities, it's really, you know, it's genuinely hard to think about. And I think that if you're someone who thinks that maybe this pandemic won't affect you or won't touch you, there are a number of experts who say that if you haven't been vaccinated, that Delta will absolutely affect you. It's that infectious, especially in a state like Florida, where, you know, things are so severe. And I read recently that if you look at the state as a country, that Florida is fourth in the world for infection. So it's, I think, Mississippi, Louisiana, Botswana, and then Florida. And so the severity here is really hard to grasp. And, you know, sometimes it's just numbers or statistics on TV, but as a doctor who's treated patients who have needed oxygen, have need to be intubated, are very sick, it's really hard to grasp how many patients need oxygen right now and are having trouble struggling to breathe.
Stacy DeLynn, MD, is our guest on WMNF Tampa 88.5 FM. It's 10:35 in the morning. And I just wanted to point out that Florida is the only state that updates its coronavirus numbers one time per week. We don't have to mention, you know, don't have to talk about that if you don't want. But I'm going to go on and talk about the vaccines. We mentioned already that the full approval of the Pfizer vaccine might lead people to get vaccinated finally. Some people have been waiting for that full approval, but other people are waiting for Novavax. What is Novavax and how is it different from the other vaccines? And where does it stand in the EU as far as getting approval? And is it likely to get approved in the United States soon?
Yeah, I'm actually not sure about where it is in European approval specifically. I know that a certain number of countries around the world are using it. It is a new type of technology that shows really, really high efficacy against coronavirus infections, including the Delta variant. And so I think people are interested in it for that reason. But I want to take a moment just to point out again that the vaccines that we have are highly, highly effective against preventing the worst health outcomes, including hospitalization and death. So, you know, it may come on the market here. It's early in the process, but we have three really effective vaccines, Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson. So I think there's no reason that we need to wait for Novavax or any new technology. I think as time passes on and we're looking more at the issues of boosters, it might be another one that we have in our arsenal, which is great. But if it's available other places in the world, that's great news because vaccination around the world is just as important as getting vaccinated here in the U.S. Variants arise other places in the world where there's low access to vaccination. And we saw a perfect example of that with the rise of Delta in India. And because they didn't have access to vaccination there and eventually made its way back here. So we should all be really excited about the fact that Novavax and other vaccines like AstraZeneca are available at other places in the world.
And you mentioned the three vaccines that we have access to here in the United States are effective. They're also almost perfectly safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there has been no more studied public health intervention in the world. And I, as someone who's done clinical research with medication and devices before, you know, we're able to push things to market with about 1/1000th of the data points that they have. So no major adverse health outcomes. One question I get a lot is like, maybe there's something that we don't know about these vaccines. We'll learn about them down the road. So the mRNA vaccine technology in particular has been around for probably about 10, 15 years. It's been used in things like Ebola. We know about the technology for a long time. And there is a history of some vaccines having adverse events after being administered. There was a type of flu vaccine that caused a type of paralysis about 30 years ago. There was a pediatric vaccine for rotavirus that caused intestinal issues. What we do know and understand about vaccines and how the immune system works is any adverse events are really seen within the first couple of weeks of administration and well understood then. When I got my vaccine, the CDC texted me every week with the VSafe app to ask, you know, if I had any adverse events, any side effects, anything to report so that they could really investigate it. And we're just not seeing any cases of, you know, anything approaching that. And we're now more than a year since the vaccine trials started. The Moderna and Pfizer trials started in June of 2020. And something I've heard, you know, people say is like, oh, maybe something will happen a year. We're past a year. Vaccine adverse events don't last that long. The vaccine components themselves, like mRNA, are in your body for about a week before your immune system clears them out. And you're just left with a good immune response should you encounter it again. So that's the reason why the FDA approved it and the reason why I continue to advocate for vaccination as safe and effective.
Our guest is Stacy DeLynn. She's a doctor, and we're talking about the coronavirus. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. I mean, we've talked somewhat during the show about Florida, and it's kind of, I don't know, rogue rules about you can't mandate masks. There's a lot of things you can't do in Florida that where people are being safe, where governments are being safe, you can do them, like mandating masks and closing certain businesses at certain times. And I spoke with, last week on the show, I spoke with the owner of an independent music venue here in Ybor City, and his name is Tom DeGeorge, and I'd like to get your thoughts on something that he said last week, so I'm going to play a short clip. And he, as I said, he's the owner of the Crowbar in Tampa's Ybor City. He's also part of the National Independent Venue Association, and he blames decision makers in Florida for the coronavirus Delta surge and also for touring musical acts for refusing to play, and I should say, he blames not just the Delta variant. I mean, obviously that happened somewhere else, but the surge. It's worse in Florida in part because of decision makers in Florida. But he also blames Florida decision makers for having touring musical acts refusing to play Florida. So here's a little clip of Tom DeGeorge, and we'll talk more about it on WMNF Tampa.
I have talked to them. I know that they're weighing different options, but I think everything is a possible threat right now. You know, if we're in a state that we can't utilize 100% of the things that are out there to keep people safe, and you're dealing with artists, like I said, that have to travel all over the country, I think we're in big trouble. I mean, we lost the Off With Their Head show. I had Skip Marley scheduled in October. I didn't even get a chance to announce that because it canceled before, and I already have several fall and winter dates that they have now held spring dates because they're concerned that if we can't get these cases down, that, you know, they don't want to come. And I had been telling people a year ago, like, hey, listen, when there's a vaccine or there's no vaccine, if we can't get these numbers under control in our state and really take this seriously, we're not going to get these bands back. And, you know, like I said, there's people that will say, hey, well, I've seen plenty of shows. There's going to be some bands that will come, but there's going to be, you know, probably 60% of them that will not under these conditions. And in order to get back, we need to be able to use all of our resources.
Well, Tom DeGeorge, before I let you go, is there anything else that you want people to know about independent music venues or about the National Independent Venue Association?
All our venues here in the state of Florida, you know, not just Crowbar, all of our venues here in the state of Florida, the Orpheum, the Ritz, Wills, big and small, you know, we've all suffered a great deal, like most Americans, over this last year and a half, and we're just trying to get back to business, and we're trying to do it in a way that is safe as possible for our customers, so the consumer confidence builds, as well as the artists, because like I said, they have to get from state to state, and asking them to go into indoor packed rooms, especially, you know, like I said, small venues like mine, you know, it's not right. So we need to make it right, and that's the only way we're going to get our industry back completely as soon as possible.
So that was Tom DeGeorge speaking on this show a week ago. He's the owner of the Crowbar in Tampa's Ybor City. He says that decision makers in Florida are responsible for hurting his business because touring musical acts are just refusing, some of them are refusing to play Florida. What are your thoughts on some of the things that he said, Dr. Stacey Dulin?
You know, what I find so interesting is that Governor DeSantis and the Republican Party of Florida, they campaign on a couple of things. Number one is individual choice and freedom of individual choice. And so, you know, if a business owner believes that they would like to require proof of vaccination in order to keep their staff safe and their customers safe, you know, that's the right of the business to be able to do that. And so it surprises me that Governor DeSantis is participating in this kind of government overreach that prevents businesses from deciding how safe that they want to keep their businesses. And the other thing is that they're pro-business, right? He's pro-business, and you're seeing these direct effects, like the caller that you had last week, talk about how he no longer can attract talent to his venue because of the fact that people recognize that they'd much, much rather go and perform at a venue that required proof of vaccination in places that they have multiple places like New York and California. Those are require full vaccination to enter restaurants, to enter concert venues, et cetera. And you're seeing it with the cruise industry as well. The cruise industry, you know, has been working hard with the CDC, and cruise ships are very well attuned to infection control. They understand, you know, the first major outbreak that we read about here in the U.S. when COVID first came to our country was on a cruise ship. And so they've been working hard to make sure that they do have everything in line so they can keep their crew and all the people who ride that cruise ship safe as they go to other countries. And so when Governor DeSantis passed a law banning proof of acting for vaccines, the cruise industries have had to go to court to fight it. And, you know, if it doesn't, so far it looks like the court decisions have gone well, but ultimately if that's a thing, Florida will continue to lose business. You know, cruise ships will move their business out of Florida. So it shocks me how much it's not in line with what they state that their, you know, sort of tenets of their administration are, because it has such negative impacts on businesses.
Our guest is Stacey DeLynn, MD, and we're on WMNF Tampa. It's 10:45 in the morning, and maybe you're listening on WMNF.org, or you might be listening on 88.5 FM or on the WMNF smartphone app. On that point about the state of Florida making sure that cruises can't ask people for their proof of vaccination, well, the cruise ships could just go elsewhere. For example, this week, the Bahamas issued an emergency order to require cruise passengers to show proof of vaccine at ports. I'm reading this from the USA Today. There have been various legal opinions for and against Governor Ron DeSantis's ban on cruise ships requiring Florida passengers to be vaccinated, as you mentioned. So we've kind of talked through that. Let me move on. One of the things that's been happening lately in the COVID-19 world is that there was a recommendation for people to get booster shots if they need it. For example, the Washington Post says the third Pfizer dose significantly lowers the risk of infections in seniors, and that's according to data from Israel. What are your thoughts about people getting a third booster shot, specifically about the 8-month wait time since the second shot? Well, I'll ask that question first and then have some follow-ups.
Sure. So, you know, Israel has been a little bit ahead of us by a couple months on how they've administered vaccines. And what they started to notice was an increase in hospitalizations and people with more serious illness after about 6 months. And so they've started providing their population with a third dose. And this third dose is really pretty well understood in medicine. A lot of the vaccinations that you got as kids, things like your Tdap vaccine, your tetanus, your hepatitis vaccines, those all require a third dose to become fully effective. And so there's a lot of evidence for it. And it looks, you know, it looks like that immunity does start to wane at about 6 months. And so, you know, healthcare workers like myself got vaccinated back in December and January. So, you know, having it roll out for everyone in September, I think seems like a really good timeline, especially given the setting, again, of such severe infection and such high rates. But I do want to point out, you know, I think that it's controversial for the international reasons, which is indicated, I think, because there's a lack of vaccine access around the world. And as I mentioned earlier, as long as we're not vaccinating the rest of the world, we'll continue to see variants rise and continue to spread back to our country. So I think that we need to be having these conversations with, do we need a third dose here? Just as importantly, we need the first doses in arms around the world in a lot of places which don't have vaccine access. So I think we absolutely should be having those conversations in tandem.
I kind of have a handle on what's going on here as far as I think the reason that we haven't vaccinated as many people as we would like in the U.S. is because some people are refusing it or have to up to this point, they've refused it. I don't really have a good handle about the rest of the world. Is it vaccine shortages or is it education campaigns where people don't realize that they're available? Do you have any handle on if there were more vaccines doses, if we could just ship millions and millions of doses around the world, would they be eagerly accepted?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's absolutely an issue of access. And while you might have some vaccine hesitancy in certain corners, mostly around the world, people are clamoring for access to vaccines. And unfortunately, you know, we have a sad track record of ignoring diseases that occur in other countries, thinking that they're not relevant to us, that, you know, we shouldn't dedicate our money or our time to these because we have this very myopic view of our own public health. But, you know, in a world that's now global with a virus that's spread through the air, we don't have the luxury of doing that anymore. So it's really, really important to get vaccine access to around the world.
And that touches on the controversy of, well, it cuts into the profits of vaccine manufacturers if they are distributed more widely, especially among poorer nations, rather than selling them at full price, perhaps, to the richer nations. What are your thoughts on making vaccines available either for free or for very reduced prices around the world compared to maximizing the profits for these vaccine companies that have had a lot of their R&D paid for by American taxpayers and other taxpayers?
Yeah, I was absolutely going to say that. Like, these vaccines have been funded through American funds, and I think we have an absolute moral and ethical responsibility to think not about cost, but to think about the health of people in the world. So there's the COVAX initiative that's working with the WHO. That's to get vaccines out through the world. You know, if you can write your elected officials to support it. I think that the U.S. so far is doing a good job of starting to address it, but it's really a drop in the bucket. We truly need billions of vaccines to be distributed around the world, and it needs to be a global effort to do that.
Our guest is Dr. Stacy DeLynn, and we're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic. We're still on boosters. I think my last question about boosters is this. The boosters were approved in the United States for Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Two questions about people who got the one dose J&J, Johnson & Johnson vaccine back in the spring or whenever they got it. One is, what do we know about potentially a booster shot for those people? It's not approved yet, but what do we know? And second, what are the pros and cons of someone who got a J&J of getting a dose of one of the mRNA vaccines?
Yeah, so because J&J came out a little bit later, the data is lagging a little bit behind. And so, people who got J&J haven't been forgotten. The good news is that J&J seems to be really, really effective against hospitalization and death. There's some decreased effectiveness in the setting of Delta. That's true across all three vaccines. It's not any different. And there's some early studies that actually suggest that J&J may have some longer lasting immunity, which is really exciting, even more so than the mRNA vaccines. So I just tell everybody that's continuing to be really, really closely followed. As soon as there's an indication that people who got Johnson & Johnson need a booster, that science will be out there and it'll be made aware. In terms of vaccine mixing, it's been really interesting. AstraZeneca is the same type of type of vaccine as Johnson & Johnson. It has a viral vector vaccine. And due to purely supply, initially people in a lot of Europe and Canada had only access to AstraZeneca and then a delay in getting a second dose. And then Pfizer came on the scene. So there was many, many people who got first AstraZeneca and then followed by a Pfizer vaccine. The name for this is heterologous prime boosting. It's a type of mixing different types of vaccines to stimulate kind of immunity. And they had really good data that it was like as effective of two doses of Pfizer, if not more. Johnson & Johnson is similar, not exactly the same. So we're still waiting for that safety data. It's being really well studied now. But I don't think that anybody who had Johnson & Johnson needs to feel forgotten or that they need to panic or do anything different. I think you're good right now. And I think that by the time booster doses start rolling out for Pfizer, Moderna recipients in September, even October, we'll start to have more data as to whether or not that's needed for Johnson & Johnson recipients.
Our guest is Stacy DeLynn, MD, and we're talking about the coronavirus pandemic. I have tons more questions, but I think maybe it's time to take a question from a listener. Teresa in St. Pete, you're on the air. What would you like to ask Dr. DeLynn?
I do cleaning for a living, and I work for people. Most of them are vaccinated. And if I go to someone every other week, and let's say I'm there today on Tuesday, and 2 weeks from today, I go, and in that, let's say a week after I go, they test positive. We're both vaccinated. Should I go get tested just to be on the safe side, or should
I think you cut off, Teresa, but I think we get your question. So, Dr. DeLynn, what would you say to that?
Yeah, so any known exposures within the last week, testing is always indicated, but exposures I do want to talk about are, the times in which you really need to be concerned are indoor unmasked interactions. So if the caller is wearing a good, well-fitting mask, the person in her house, whose house she's going to is also masked, it's pretty low risk. And so again, mask work. But a lot of people who work in jobs in which they're at the public, working with the public on a regular basis, including myself, get tested regularly just to be extra safe. So you're never wrong to get a test, but just remembering that masks really do work. And so just encouraging her clients to wear them and making sure she always wears them when she goes in the house.
Thank you for that call, Teresa. And I want to ask a question of Dr. DeLynn about pregnant women. Should pregnant women get vaccinated against COVID-19?
Yes, very simple answer. And I think that over the last year, the initial trials weren't done on pregnant women. And then it was sort of in this space where it was like, oh, you know, a pregnant person can talk to their doctor and they can make that decision together, risk versus benefits. But since then we have, again, just enormous amount of data. So people who were in the original trial got pregnant. People who were having those conversations with their doctor decided to get pregnant anyway. We've seen no increased rates of things like miscarriages, low birth weights, any negative fetal outcomes, and no impacts on fertility in any way. That's been studied really well. One thing I really caution people about is that, you know, sometimes people will say, I read on my friend's Facebook page that they had a miscarriage and they got vaccinated a couple of weeks before. So obviously the vaccine caused the miscarriage. These issues have been studied really well. And there's no difference if you look at both groups, people who had the vaccine and didn't, that there's any increased risks of miscarriages or any risks to the developing baby. But what we do also absolutely know is pregnancy is considered a very high risk condition. So if you get COVID infection while pregnant, you're much more likely to end up in the ICU. You're much more likely to have a fetal demise or a miscarriage. You're much more likely to have premature birth. It's very, very serious. And additionally, vaccination through the antibodies that the mom passes to the baby through the placenta and through delivery can actually have protective benefits for the baby. So absolutely, if you're pregnant, you're in a high-risk group, get vaccinated. It's well known to be very safe.
Our guest is Stacey DeLynn, MD, and you're listening to WMNF Tampa on 88.5 FM. We're going to talk now a little bit about disinformation, misinformation about vaccines, and I'll let a caller, someone who emailed in a question, Kelly O, wrote, "Lately I've heard from too many friends that variants of COVID arise because of the vaccine, and it's better to get natural immunity through catching COVID. While I do not believe this and continue to encourage my family and friends to get vaccinated, can you discuss the science of mutations? Do vaccines cause more mutations?" She goes on, but I think that's a good stopping point. What would you say about mutations?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like from a scientific perspective, that's hard to understand. A vaccine prevents infection, and infection passing from one person to another is how viral variations arise. So the vaccine contains no live virus in any way, so there's just no way that it could lead to a mutation. I think, you know, she's probably hearing it from a lot of friends and family, because one thing I've learned while trying to do science communication, which I didn't know anything about before COVID, was that there's a really, really well-funded, highly profitable anti-vaccine industry. And, you know, at the end of what they're saying, when they say don't get vaccinated, there's also usually a pitch that comes with it. That's like, you need natural immunity. And the best way to get natural immunity is to take these vitamins that I'm selling, to try these tinctures, to follow my account closely so I can tell you every day how to boost your natural immunity through whatever else. And then the social media companies also really, really sadly profit off of this by these anti-vax accounts getting followers, by their marketplaces being used to sell you whatever immune boosting supplement or whatever else it is. And so you'll notice these pieces of misinformation come in waves, but they're not founded in any science. So once again, I really urge people to look at the major regulatory and medical bodies, the CDC, the FDA, the WHO, and you know, your major medical organizations that you trust. If you have a kid, look to the American Academy of Pediatrics. If you're a pregnant person, look to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. That's where you're going to get a review of all the available science to tell you that vaccines are safe and effective.
I'm going to play devil's advocate right now. You just told me to go to the government and find out from the government the information. What are you? You just trust the government about everything, Stacey?
I don't. I actually trust science and I trust scientists. And, you know, one thing that I know from working in medicine is that the government isn't one body, and that it's made up of thousands of scientists reviewing thousands of bodies of evidence. And, you know, they're doing really, really hard work to keep all of us safe. And so I do, you know, I trust those people.
Here's a headline in today's Tampa Bay Times. COVID-19 is pushing Tampa Bay ambulance service to its limits and beyond. The subheadline there says extra shifts, constant 911 calls, hours long waits at the hospital. It's a tough time for emergency medical systems in Hillsborough, Pasco, and Pinellas counties. So you might be completely vaccinated. You might take your mask wearing seriously. You might distance yourself from other people. And then if you have a different medical emergency, now you're being impacted from COVID-19. I don't know. Any takeaway message here for people to really get serious about taking on this pandemic?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I had a friend who took up bike riding recently and I was like, be really careful. Like now is not the time to break a bone. I've had other friends who have had their elective surgeries canceled. You know, and when I say elective, you know, these are like something that a doctor might have scheduled for long-term, you know, making your heart better, placing stem, things like this that are having to be rescheduled. And so, you know, in terms of everyone wanting personal freedom to not make these decision to get vaccinated, these decisions are affecting all of us. So as much as you can, even if you're vaccinated, you're mask wearing, take the time to be patient with those or who around you who haven't been vaccinated yet. Talk to them about the safety of vaccination because it really does affect all of us.
Well, I am sorry to say that we are out of time. This has been super enjoyable. Thanks very much for coming on WMNF for the hour, Stacey.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for helping to fight misinformation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, too. That's Stacey DeLynn, MD, and thanks to Barbara Fling for answering our phones. I'm Sean Canaan. If you're a resident of St. Petersburg, today is the primary election for governor and for three city council races. If no candidate gets a majority today, the top two will face off in November's general election. VoteFinellis.com has more information. Please consider staying tuned for Janelle Irwin because in 5 minutes, we will hear her talk to several of the St. Pete mayoral candidates. That's coming up after NPR headlines. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening to 88.5 FM.